And welcome to Inside Albania with me, Alice Taylor. Today, I am in the beautiful French city of Strasbourg. Behind me is the Council of Europe, a pan-European human rights organization with 46 members, including most of the European Union. Today, there will be a debate on whether Kosovo's bid to be a member will be accepted. But I'm not here just to talk about Kosovo, although I will be interviewing people on the outcome of the debate. I'm also here to learn about the 75 years of this organization's history, what it means for members, and what it can offer to member states. Come with me for interviews and more from Strasbourg, France. Haide me mua. So right now I'm in the European Parliament building in Strasbourg. Now in the room behind me, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe is having its plenary session. And today there are two main topics on the agenda. The first is a resolution, a debate initiated by Luzlin Basha on the reconstruction of Ukraine. So what he has proposed is that Russian assets seized outside of Russia be used to rebuild and reconstruct Ukraine, but also to compensate those who have been impacted by its illegal actions and its war. The second debate is that of Kosovo's application to become a member of the Council of Europe. This second session is scheduled to take 3 hours, but it's expected to go on a little bit longer than that. I have a very, very busy afternoon ahead of me. Come on, let's go take a look inside.
The decision we take today may seem complex, but it's in fact one of the simplest calls we have to make.
So I've just come quickly out of the first session where Luzlin Basha has addressed the plenary. And basically he has called for a mechanism to be created whereby all assets seized by other states are transferred to one international fund. So that's all Russian assets seized by one state are transitioned to one international fund, which will then be used not just to reconstruct Ukraine after the war, but also to pay compensation to people who have been impacted by it. Basically, it's considered that as Russia's actions are illegal under international law, there is redress for the victims of this. So this is what has been proposed today. We've heard statements from the UK as well as members of Ukrainian Parliament. There was one comment in particular from Lord Fawkes from the UK who said, you know, basically London has been built on Russian money. It earned the name Londongrad. And basically we should be doing a lot more rather than just sort of saying, oh yes, we'll use Russian assets to rebuild, to reconstruct. Actually, we need to be sending more ammunition. We need to be making more assistance in terms of military help. And we have to ensure that Ukraine wins the war, not just that we pick up the pieces and pay compensation afterwards. So that's sort of been the gist of things so far. I'm going to head back in now because they are going to put it to a vote. So day two at the Council of Europe yesterday was an extremely exciting day, an extremely long day. I started at 5 a.m. I don't think I finished until gone 11 p.m. So the first debate we had in the plenary was that tabled by Luzlin Basha for the reconstruction of Ukraine using seized Russian assets to finance the reconstruction and the compensation of the Ukrainian people. This passed unanimously, which is great when we consider at the United European Union level, they're struggling to get any sort of consensus on a similar sort of initiative. We then saw a very, very intense debate going on over Kosovo's membership to the Council of Europe. There were a number of amendments filed, mainly by Serbia and also by Italy. And there were over 60 speakers that took to the floor to give their support or opposition to the proposal. Of course, Serbia was very, very critical of Kosovo's membership bid. Serbian representatives called the rapporteur who tabled the report in favour of Kosovo's membership a hypocrite, said that she will be remembered in history, and said that Kosovo will always be Serbia, which did not go down well with the chair of the plenary, who called for restraint and not using inflammatory language. There were also quite a few stony faces from the Kosovo delegation up in the gallery. We also heard from the Montenegro representative, who was against Kosovo's membership. And she said, although Montenegro has recognised Kosovo as an independent country, she did not agree as a Serb. We had very, very positive statements from Ukraine as well, who told Serbia that the era of the Serbian Empire is over. It's time to turn a page, move away from Putin, and be embraced by Europe. And part of this is allowing Kosovo to ascend to the Council of Europe. Anyway, the amendments were voted on and it was all very, very tense. We were waiting up in the gallery for each vote to be counted. All of the amendments were dismissed. And then the final vote on the draft opinion for Kosovo to be a member, and we were waiting, you know, everyone was casting their votes and you have a few moments to wait until the votes have been counted and they're displayed on the screen. And you sort of stand there and you check and you're looking and you're counting, you're doing the maths in your head. And it's just this moment. And then suddenly everyone cheered and was happy. But it was quite funny because you could see people really wanted to go, yes, but you have to be restrained in this environment. Afterwards, there was an event organised by the Kosovo delegation, hosted by the Prime Minister Albin Kurti, where we went and we celebrated, and I spoke to lots of people who were extremely happy about what had happened. And we also spoke about the next steps, which is the ministerial committee meeting scheduled for May. And this is the final decision. A two-thirds majority will see Kosovo become a member of the Council of Europe. It was a fantastic day, my first visit to the Council of Europe, and to be part of such a historic event. Today, I'm going to be speaking to people from the Albanian delegation to find out a bit more about the Council of Europe in terms of what it does, how it functions, what benefit it brings to Albania, what benefit Albania brings to the Council of Europe, and how countries, Albania and in the future Kosovo, can work better with this institution for the benefits of their societies. Thank you very much for your address in the plenary session yesterday. It was very moving to hear. Can you explain for our viewers, Ukraine is a country that doesn't formally recognise Kosovo for lots of complicated reasons. How can you support its membership so vociferously, so strongly, when you don't recognise?
First of all, I think Ukraine should recognise Kosovo. And I'm the author of the bill to Ukrainian parliament to recognise Kosovo. Unfortunately, it's still not adopted. But for me, everything is clear. Kosovo deserves to be part of civilized world, to be part of Europe, and Kosovo deserves its independence. Mm. So I think there is a lot of common, unfortunately, in the fate of Ukrainians and Kosovans. We both are coming through genocide, and that is very, for me, it's important. And I really feel sorry about what had happened. And I think that we need to give these people this chance. And I'm sure that they will use it in the best possible way.
And I want to ask as well, we have Spain, which is saying it's not going to recognize Kosovo, yet it's planning to recognize Palestine. We have other non-recognizing states, Greece as well, Romania, Slovakia. What message do you have for them coming from a country which is also has its own territorial problems? What message do you have for them in terms of being able to support Kosovo without jeopardizing their own domestic issues?
I think it's very clear because Kosovo has a decision of United Nations that they have the right for sovereignty. And in Ukraine, we have a clear occupation from Russia. It's not about any self-determination. It's just a clear aggression and occupation. In other countries, they don't have this problem of some parts of their territory where people have any decision of the United Nations. In general, what we're speaking about, I mean, from 2 million of people who live in Kosovo, Serbians are less than 100,000. Mm. What do we want? To take these people and to make them part of Serbia again. I mean, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. That will never happen. And it's clear. And by this non-recognition, we are making worse for Serbia. Yesterday, I also addressed to Serbs. And I said, you need to go through this finally. You need to finish this story about great Serbia, the empire, Balkan empire, and so on. You need to be a wonderful democratic state, how you could be. Move through this. Like Germany was, that was a disaster for the whole world when it was empire. Now it's a wonderful, fantastic democratic country, democratic, great, because they stopped to be empire, and they win from the more than any other country in the world. So the same about Serbs. All these is now like phantom pains, you know, and that should be stopped. And Balkans should live freely. And also, when we have these gray zones, sooner or later there will be war there. And we have forces in the world which wants this war. Moscow, Iran, and others, they will be happy to see new fire in the Balkans. They want to have as much fire in the world as possible. So we need to prevent this and not to play games with this.
And my last question, we're looking at potentially the middle of May for the Committee of Ministers meeting. This could potentially be a bit more of a challenge for Kosovo. What are your, without wanting to jinx it, are you hopeful of a positive outcome?
No, I'm sure. I think yesterday's vote was, results of yesterday's vote was very clear. 130 against 29 or something like this. It's so clear and overwhelming. So I think everything will be okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for making the time to speak to me. We had a really interesting morning at the European Court of Human Rights and the Venice Commission, which for me, as a journalist who's been following the Council of Europe for a long time, was quite a geeky, exciting sort of experience to actually go to these places that I've written about so much in the past. What I want to know from you, in terms of Albania, we've been a member of the Council of Europe since 1995. And what I want to know is, how do we stack up against other countries in terms of the number of cases filed at the European Court of Human Rights? And then what happens afterwards? So how well are we enforcing or not enforcing the judgments? Because this is the important bit.
Sure. Okay. Well, as a general rule, we try not to make league tables of our member states, but we look at each country individually. Yep. And I can certainly give you some figures about Albania and the number of applications and their implementation. So last year, 2023, for example, there were 133 applications from Albania that were referred to a judicial formation of the court. So that means at least one judge is going to look at those applications. And that is compared to a total figure of around 35,000 applications last year. So Albania isn't the biggest customer of the court, if you like, by any means. But if you look at the number of applications in relation to population size, we see that for Albania last year, there were around 48 applications per 1 million inhabitants. Whereas for the Council of Europe as a whole, there were 41 applications per 1 million inhabitants. So it's kind of slightly above average, I guess. In terms of the number of judgments concerning Albania last year, again, Albania wasn't the biggest customer of the court by any means. There were 21 judgments against concerning Albania. And 20 of those found at least one violation of the Human Rights Convention. So it's a relatively small number of cases, but you can see that in most cases last year, at least,
there was
the
an
court
issue.
Found a violation. Then, as you know, after the court makes a judgment, it passes to the Council of Europe, the Committee of Ministers, to make sure that that judgment is put into practice. And if we look at the figures before the Committee of Ministers, we can see that so far Albania has closed around 53% of the judgments from the court. And that means the committee is satisfied that enough has been done by the authorities to rectify the violation that was found and to make sure that it doesn't happen again. We find that the implementation rate so far is around 39% for Albania. So there's room for improvement.
There's room.
But in a lot of these cases that are still showing as pending before the Committee of Ministers, states have already taken significant steps in the right direction. So that doesn't mean that 61% have been ignored or forgotten about. It means they're in progress.
It's not that the government's gone, oh, we don't care about that. You know, we're not interested. It's maybe it takes time. They have to get to it. They have to figure out how to. There's a whole range of different factors.
Yeah. And sometimes that means changing laws, possibly even changing the constitution. And those things take time and they can be very politically difficult.
Especially in Albania, time is a problem, especially in our court system. We have a huge backlog of cases. We have a shortage of judges, of prosecutors, of everything, which brings me on to my next question. I often hear people saying, oh, you know, you should take this to the European Court of Human Rights. And then I hear the other party saying, oh, no, it's going to take too long, or maybe I can't afford it. Or the fact that you have to exhaust domestic processes, legal recourse, before you can go to the European Court of Human Rights. I hear this a lot. Can you explain a bit for people who are watching, if they have a complaint which they think merits the attention of the European Court of Human Rights, do they have to exhaust the local court process? Does it have to take years and years and years?
The convention and the convention system is very much a safety net. And it's supposed to be there to help people when things go wrong at national level. So we work together with our member states, and the main responsibility for implementing the convention is with the national authorities. So the court does insist that people go the whole way through the national system before they bring cases to Strasbourg. But people can also complain to the court that my national system isn't working very well, or it's going too slowly, or so on. And the court will take that into account. But that going as far as possible through the national system is a very important requirement. Otherwise, the court here would be swamped with cases from all over Europe, and it's already dealing with a very
How many cases was it that were pending? You did say
there are around 68,000 applications pending.
Wow.
And that includes all 46 member states plus Russia.
Plus, yeah.
Because although Russia has now left, any cases relating to the period up until the moment where they were no longer bound by the convention, our court still has a duty to process those cases.
And my last question, part of the reason I'm here at the moment, and thank you for that, for the invitation, is because it's 75 years since the Council of Europe was established. Now, a lot has happened in those 75 years. Can you explain a little bit, give me an overview, you know, what does this mean to people working here, to the member states? What's coming up? You know, what can we expect?
Well, the Council of Europe has a very long history. As you know, it predates the European Union. It has 46 member states, so we grew very rapidly, certainly after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the Council and the Court and the Convention have played a really important part in maintaining and promoting our kind of what we see as the fundamental European values, so human rights, democracy, and the rule of law. We're now facing a whole load of different challenges and emerging challenges. So we have, on one hand, environmental issues, which are starting to come before the court, and the Council of Europe is doing more work on the environment. We're also working on emerging issues like artificial intelligence to make sure that those things are developed in a way that respects people's privacy, for example. Freedom of the media, freedom of speech is another one of our key values that is protected under the convention. And we find that as Europe changes, the work that we do changes as well. And as we know, Europe is going through a difficult period. We have quite widespread challenges to many of those values that the organisation was set up to protect in many different countries. So it's an interesting time ahead. We also have to bear in mind that the Council of Europe has a lot of member states, a very wide range of topics. In monetary terms, we have a lot less resources than, say, the European
it's
Union.
0.5% of the EU's budget, if I remember
correctly.
I've heard
it said that we spend in a year what the EU spends in one afternoon. So there's a lot to do. It's an ongoing job that is never, you know, we can never say, yes, this is complete. There are different challenges in all of our member states, but there are challenges in all of our member states for us to work.
I find in my reporting, people back home, they get a bit confused. They think the Council of Europe is the same as the European Council. The media reports about what happens here, but I don't think they really understand or know that much about it. Why is there this confusion? How can we improve this?
The Council of Europe is an European organization having a larger number of members from the European states than the European Union. Indeed, the European Union is the organization of a fewer number of states that are all European, and the other European states, including here the Balkan states, are willing to be part of the European Union. In terms of scope, the Council of Europe is the organization created for the promotion of democracy, human rights, and rule of law. And these are the pillars in which the Council of Europe was created. Indeed, the European Union do have these principles as well, but it's more like a political organization of 28 states together to have the same rules in terms of legal framework, in terms of traditions, in terms of having the same policies in all sectors of life. But of course, the European Union do uphold the principle of the Council of Europe. However, when we talk for the Council of Europe, we can say that it is the organization in which parliamentarians of all the countries take part in a mechanism that is called the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. And this is the legislative body of the Council of Europe. Meanwhile, there is an executive branch, if we can put it like that, of the Council of Europe, that is the Committee of Ministers. The Committee of Ministers is composed of all the ministers that are competent for the foreign affairs of each of the member states, and they do have all the decision-making powers in the organization of the Council of Europe. These are the two main bodies in the Council of Europe. Meanwhile, there are a lot of other mechanisms that help the implementation of the decisions from the Parliamentary Assembly, so the legislative branch, and the executive branch, the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe. And these mechanisms do help the state members to achieve the best standards for democracy, human rights, and rule of law. The importance of the Council of Europe, it's its court. There is an European Court, the European Court of Human Rights. It is a binding instrument which, for all the member states, it constitutes a kind of watchdog, if I can say it like this, for the people to understand. So each of the citizens in all 46 member states, if they claim a violation of their human rights, they have the right to request remedy in their national courts. Mm-hmm. And if they are not satisfied with their remedies, upon the completion of all the process in the national courts, they have the right to refer to the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights normally adjudicates based on the complaints of the citizens against member states referring to the violation of human rights. Mm-hmm. If the European Court of Human Rights here in Strasbourg decide that there is a violation and it rules even on how to resolve it, the member states, the mechanism at the local level, so meaning at the state level, do have an obligation to implement such decisions. So giving such a powerful tool to all the citizens in the member states to get protected from the violation of human rights.
But how is it to implement? You get this judgment from the European Court of Rights, and I know I've seen the figures, like member states have different implementation rates, and some of them were like 30%, some were 60%. And the expert explained to me, you know, it's not a simple process to implement judgments. You can't just take the judgment from the court and then just make it happen. You have to, what is the process for doing that?
It's a challenging process. Each country has its own methodology, which is, of course, provided by rules, so by laws in each of the countries. There are specific mechanism, institution in each of the countries that are obliged to take the decision-making of the Strasbourg Court and to transform it into a binding action in their country. And it doesn't end here, because the Council of Europe do has the mechanism to monitor the member states, how do they implement the decision of the Strasbourg court? And if these decisions are not implemented as requested, of course, there are even penalties from for the member states. No states would like to have backslidings.
And also these things get picked up by the media as well. It becomes an
media
issue.
It's a very strong actor in order to make the decision of the Strasbourg court be implemented efficiently in the member states, and media is one of the main partners of the Council of Europe as well, not only for the Strasbourg court decision implementation, but even for all the other issues that covers the Council of Europe. I could say that in Balkan, compared to other European countries that are even members in the European Union, there are sometimes better figures of implementation than in those other countries. However, the Council of Europe, I believe, should be more active in promoting its mechanisms, in promoting its decision-making, and should narrow the gap between its decision-making and the citizens, because this is an organization to serve to the people, those that are citizens of the member states. Sometimes I doubt that the citizens are very much aware of what the Council of Europe is offering to them. And indeed, it's offering a lot. So people can benefit from a mere group of mechanisms to protect human rights, to protect the democracy, to guarantee the rule of law. So I think now with this last year's, this trend has been positively improved.
Yesterday, well, it was the Kosovo vote, which was a resounding success. Do you have a comment on that? How did it make you feel personally as someone involved with the Council of Europe to see this happen?
Well, the Kosovo vote yesterday was a fair decision. And I do strongly believe that Kosovo deserves a place as an equal member together with the other 46 member in the Council of Europe, because Kosovo has made progress in all of the fields related to democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. And so the citizens of Kosovo should be given the opportunity to benefit from all this mechanism of the protection from the European Court of Human Rights. Having said that, this is just the beginning of a trip. Now, there is another process that has to be done very soon, I hope in May, by the Committee of Ministers, who should definitely decide the membership of Kosovo in the Council of Europe. And this is a decision to be taken. So I'm looking forward for a positive decision. And in terms of Albanians, I'm very proud because we'll have more Albanians in the Council of Europe. And this is a merit-based process. And this is an historical, just decision. So I cannot deny that I'm so happy. I'm very enthusiastic for that. And I just hope that the Committee of Ministers will take the same decision and will take into consideration the recommendation from the Parliamentary Assembly that the Kosovo should be the 47th member of the Council of Europe. So,
fingers crossed. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
So this year is the 75th year anniversary of the establishment of the Council of Europe. Could you tell me a bit about what is planned in terms of celebrations marking this event? And also, what can we look forward to between now and the next big milestone, which is the 100-year anniversary?
Well, first of all, thank you for your interest in the Council of Europe and our anniversary, which indeed is a great occasion to remind our member states and the citizens of the achievements of this first pan-European organisation after the Second World War. And just to reiterate some of the great achievements we have, a really groundbreaking treaty for the protection of women against violence and domestic violence, which is now being also adopted by the European Union. We have unique monitoring mechanisms, which no other organization has in that form, against discrimination, against money laundering, against corruption, against many human rights violations. And last but not least, we have a unique system of human rights protection with the court and the implementation of judgments by the member states and the supervision of that implementation by our Committee of Ministers. And this is unique and probably wouldn't be established in this day and time. It was something that came out of the spirit after the Second World War of wanting unity and wanting solidarity and our claim that never again would we see such a breakdown of human rights. And I think, moving on to your next question, while we celebrate these achievements with many events, around 20 events in the member states, with a major celebration here in Strasbourg, with the participation of several, probably all ministers, foreign ministers of the Council of Europe, and with other events, while we celebrate that, we also have to look forward to the future and what our aims are there. And I think you've seen the motto, united around our values. I think this is the biggest challenge, that Europe remains united around those fundamental rights, around the fundamental rights of the European Convention on Human Rights. We are seeing in several parts of Europe, in several sectors, tendencies to perhaps take these rights less seriously than we have in the past. And therefore, unity is the big aim. We showed unity when we expelled Russia from this organization because it was simply no longer tenable to have that as a member Russia as a member state with its massive human rights violations. That was one big moment of unity against Russia, and we are sustaining that with all our help at the moment for Ukraine. Ukraine is our top priority, and also to compensate the victims of Russian aggression in Ukraine. And this was the big achievement of the Reykjavik summit, which was the establishment of a register of damage. This has only just now started working. So that's the immediate future and our concrete contribution to bringing justice to the victims of Russian aggression in Ukraine. And beyond that, I think the challenge, the biggest challenge, which we share with the European Union and the United Nations, is to sustain multilateral cooperation and to uphold those rights against those forces who want to destroy them or want to weaken them for their own political gains. And I think that is going to be our biggest challenge. I would like to say this organization will be there in 75 years, probably in 100 years, maybe in a different form, maybe in different forms of cooperation, in particular with the European Union. But our job right now at this anniversary is to remind people of the achievements, the role of this organization as Europe's leading human rights protector, the guardian of human rights, to show what role we have in the general architecture of Europe's institutions, to do that also in education, in schools, because it's so important that people know how these rights and where they are established and how they're being protected, and to gain support for our future. And I think that is the biggest challenge. And this is why we're happy to work with everybody who supports this, journalists and civil rights activists and defenders who are so important in civil society. And there is, again, another area where we need to work in future, supporting civil society across all countries in Europe.
That's all for this week. You can tune into Inside Albania on Euronews Albania every Saturday at 5 o'clock on our YouTube channel, Euronews Albania, or across all major podcasting platforms. Next time, I'll be back in Albania and back in the studio with some interesting debate and discussion just for you. Until then, Miro Papshin.